Welcome, everyone, to the Space Game Junkie Podcast. I, as always, am your co-host, Brian, and joining me, as always, is your co-host, Jim.
Heidi ho.
And we have a guest this week, rather than just Jim and I boring you to death for the past couple weeks. we have a guest this week. Do you prefer Christopher or Chris?
Chris.
Okay. We have a guest this week. You just told me Chris, and anyway. You know, I see it, Skype thing right there, it says Christopher, that totally threw me. Chris Park, founder and lead developer at Arkin Games. I said that right?
Yep, you got it.
I've been saying Arson for years.
Which, it's about 50-50. Yeah. It, you know, it's
Koken.
You know, all the Latin I used to take, I see a C like that. I'm like, a hard C. And apparently a lot of other people think we're into setting fires.
Yeah. So it's like the whole, like, soda or pop.
Yeah.
Don't get me started. Do not get me started. My part of Pennsylvania always said soda, and the other half of Pennsylvania always said pop. And whenever the twain came together, always an argument. Every time.
I believe we've gotten started.
Okay. Anyway, so we have brought Chris here because Arkin Games, I'm going to really try and say that right the entire show, but I'm probably going to mess it up at least once. Arkin Games is returning to space gaming. They have AI War.
Would you say it's a triumphant returning to space gaming?
It looks triumphant, but we don't know yet. Let's find out. First, you have AI War, and it's 5, 6 expansions now? 5?
That's a lot of expansions.
5 so far.
Yeah.
Doing them.
It's working on another one, apparently. I've seen rumblings of another one being.
Yeah, there should be one in maybe March, something like that.
Yeah, I guess we should mention AI War is in the current Humble Bundle, isn't it? Or was it previous one? Or it's on Bundle Stars?
There was a whole sale a few weeks, about a month ago.
Mm-hmm. Yes, in the current Indie Royale bundle, it was in a Humble Weekly sale.
What I was thinking of. How can anyone keep track of all these things?
You know, in Europe, they call it the Indie Royale because they have the metric system.
Oh, my God. And okay. We're already getting off to a great start. Okay, so we have AI War, which I'm going to be honest. I call myself a space game junkie. That came out when I was kind of taking a break from games, and so when I got back into gaming, there was so much shiny that I never really, you know,
sure.
Pretty shiny thing. So I tried it a weekend or so ago. I put about 3 or 4 hours into it.
So you almost made it through the tutorial mission.
Almost made it through the tutorial mission. Then I crawled into a corner and cried for a while.
Oh, come on.
I was actually playing. I was actually playing through the tutorial today on that myself, because when it went on sale, Brian sent me a copy. And it's kind of neat, you know. I'm a little bit intimidated at what it looks like the scale is going to get to be, though, because it seems to be a simulation about cloud AI, you know, like where you see these where people are talking about, like, you watch a TED talk and they're like, yeah, we're building these robots, and they talk to each other, and then you just, like, pour them out like a swarm on the floor, and they organize themselves and run around, and that's kind of what I'm seeing my ships doing, right? And
That's exactly it. It's a tri-layer AI, actually. I did a lot of detailed write-ups, actually, about it, a whole series of blog posts back in 2009. But it has some kind of macro decision-making, and that it has...
It's very impressive to watch.
Oh, thanks. Very impressive. Yeah, and we wind up simulating... it really varies, but a lot of games have 40 to 80,000 ships being simulated in there. And we've had players with a couple of 100,000.
Oh, my God.
We had somebody who enabled some, you know, there's cheat codes, and somebody had enabled some cheat codes and messed around with some stuff, and they had a wave of ships coming in that was 16 million ships. And, this was like a total cheat code thing, right? And so they said... It didn't crash their computer, but as soon as, you know, it's like counting down 16 million ships arriving to planet blah blah in, you know, 10 minutes, 10, you know, 10, 9, 8. And they're like, oh God, what's going to happen when this happens? So it, you know, 16 million ships arrive, and it just kind of, the game freezes. And they're like, all right, I'm going to leave it and see what it does. You know, they leave. They come back like 20 minutes later, and it's, you know, chugging along like frame at a time. And they're like, holy cow, look at all the stuff that just appeared. It's still running. You know, it's going to take, you know, 10 years to get through the next 10 seconds of gameplay. But,
I got to say, the art for a lot of the games of yours I've played, like A Valley Without Wind, and I just started playing Bionic Dews, which is, I'm liking that. The art is to a point where it's not like indie simple, but it's simple enough where it could run really well on just about any machine. And with a game like AI War, that sounds really important with all the units.
That's something that we take great advantage of, because the data footprint is something that we are always having to really carefully manage. And, you know, keeping the AI from, you know, even with the second thread, keeping the AI from just completely hogging your system, it is, you know, because some of like the auto-targeting stuff is really kind of a dumb level of AI. It's not really the cloud AI. It's just kind of a, you know, I'm the gunner sitting in a ship. Here I am in the moment. What do I shoot at? You know, and if I don't have other orders and I'm not in range of something, then what do I go to? You know, so that's kind of the bottommost layer. And that one has to run in real time, and it's a bear, you know, throttling that such that they, you know, move quickly, but it doesn't like bog stuff down when there's 2,000 ships versus 2,000 ships, or, you know, 7,000 ships versus 4,000 ships or whatever. And so it's been a really fun and challenging engineering.
I'm definitely going to play more. I was really enjoying what I was playing, even though I was scared to death. I was really impressed with what I was saying. And I got to say, it kind of harkens back to a simpler time of gaming where you get a game like this. It came with either a spiral-bound manual or a several-hundred-page manual, because now you have wikis, and my God, the wikis for this game. Holy crap. But that's another podcast. But it would come with this huge manual and have all these tutorials. And, you know, you could sink hundreds of hours into it. And at one time, I would have the time to do that.
Oh,
but
yeah.
I'm finding that I don't. But what I love about this game is that not only does it exist in this day and age where people have less gaming time, less gaming attention, more games to choose from. Not only do I love that they exist, but people are loving it. People are playing it. People are sinking the time into it that I don't have.
We got folks with 600 hours on Steam on it. It's pretty crazy. We've got people that consider themselves still pretty new to the game with 100 hours in.
I could believe it. I mean, and I could totally believe it.
It's been a really interesting journey for a lot of folks, and it's grossed over $1 million now as well.
Congratulations!
So,
that's wonderful. Congratulations.
So, I mean, it really shows to me just how strong the niches can be.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, this niche, the space game niche, has never really gone away. It was just abandoned. You know, but the fans have never gone anywhere.
And even space game, you know, that's a broad term.
You know,
there's so many space themed sorts of games, and
spaceship games, you know, like RTS games like yours, Sins of Solar Empire, turn based games. I mean, games that focused on spaceships.
Yeah, and like the Descent Free Space and all that sort of thing. And I'm loving seeing, you know, all this stuff coming back.
Oh, isn't it great?
So,
isn't it great? I mean, I'll tell you, when I started the site, I've said this before. When I started the site, I thought it was going to be like the occasional new game, and I was going to be talking about old games most of the time. It's been the exact opposite. And it's amazing. It's amazing. So after AI War, you spread out a little bit. You did the Valley Without Wind games, which I really enjoyed. I didn't get too far because, God, they got hard. Either that or I sucked, but, God, they got hard. And then Skyward Collapse, which I have not played, but I hear that's very good. Then Bionic Dews, which is the most recent one.
Mm-hmm.
And I played a little of that, and I'm liking it. I'm liking the kind of hands-on WASD, yet not fully, you know, hold down the shift to attack type.
Yeah, what
it's kind of a mix.
What is that game? Because I've looked at some screenshots of it, and it almost looks like Space Hulk with robots, but then it zooms out to this big city map.
It's basically a roguelike.
Okay.
Yeah.
And it's you know, it combines tactics a little more. I mean, all roguelikes have some tactics, but it combines a bit more with that because position matters a lot more because all the combat is ranged and the weapons are weird and the robots are weird.
I like the robots. Like, the weirder the better, actually.
There's a ninja robot and a science robot. That's all I've gotten seen so far is a ninja robot.
Now, do you build a team of robots or are you just one guy that you upgrade yourself?
You've got a squad of four like exosuits basically that you're sending through, but you only control one at a time. And if one dies, you swap in another, or you can swap them in and out at will. We did the actual like squad based thing before that, but it felt too slow. So we said, okay, control one at a time, and that makes more direct.
It really does.
Yeah, I mean that just sped it up so much.
But it's action. It's not a turn based thing.
It is. It's basically roguelike time. If you've played any other roguelikes, I mean, you can kind of, you know, you right click on a guy and it shoots him right then. You press W and he moves north. But if you don't do anything, neither does the enemy. And every time you like take an action, then all the enemies that are alerted take an action.
Looking at like potential for a touch interface. Like if you could take it to iPad or something like that.
We probably could. Yeah, there would be some. It would slow it down, the flow, quite a bit, but we could probably do it. The potential for hilarious mistouches would be pretty high on that one, too.
So what about like Last Federation, the new game that you're working on? Would that be something friendly to a touch interface? Or as a developer, are tablets on your radar now? Because that's where the audience seems to be for a lot of things.
It is certainly on our radar. We actually bought the dev tools for it because we could get them on discount like a year ago, but we haven't done anything with it yet. Our puzzle game, Tidalis, we've thought about putting over there.
I knew I was forgetting one. Sorry about that.
Two, actually. Shattered Haven, too, we had.
Oh, for God's sakes.
We've had a busy year.
That's pretty. I was gonna bring that up. You guys have just been pounding out the games, which is amazing.
Well, the beauty of the current distribution model with Steam and Greenlight and Desera and now the Humble Bundle stuff and the other bundle sites and all these guys, right? The nice thing about that is that it's the long tail, right? Because that you don't have to compete for retail space or whatever. You're there. And people can find the game forever, and you don't have to worry about a distribution model and all that. So I think that's a really nice enabler for the indies.
It is. It's getting more crowded, for sure. The you know, I happen to, with AI War, just by chance, be kind of at the start of the modern indie revolution, you know, in 2009. That's, you know, when the modern indie stuff really started kicking off. I mean, the iPhone and, you know, just on all sorts of platforms. You know, and AI War was only like the 74, 76, something like that, indie game on Steam between 2004 and late 2009. And then, like, if you look at Greenlight, you know, like just last month or whatever, they just greenlit 100 indie 100, games.
100 freaking games, yeah, my God.
And that's not even counting the ones that don't have to go through Greenlight. Like, we don't go through Greenlight on ours, and a lot of other indies that, you know, have, you know, pre-existing solid relationships with Steam, we just, you know, none of us go through Greenlight. So, you know, I don't even know how many indie games are coming out a year or now, but I mean, it's like practically more a month than there were in the first like 8 years.
Just the space games that I'm keeping track of, it feels like there's so many. Not that it's a bad thing, especially given the last several years where there was next to nothing, and that's all we had were little indies, but my God, it's hard to keep track of.
So it's a good thing. So there's competing for press space, and there's competing for storefront space.
Right.
You know, because that's, you know, the attention of the eyeballs is always going to be limited. Yeah,
of course, Steam has a storefront. They have their sale pages. They have their featured, you know, their featured sales and all that stuff. And I was going to ask, how do you maintain visibility with all this increasing competition?
A lot of it is just periodically doing something that gets us either on the front page of Steam or that gets us some sort of other press. And so, that can be, doing a discount promotion. You kind of have to do those periodically in order to stay visible. Expansions that we do, when we do one of those tend to break even like ridiculously fast. I mean, within the first week, they tend to break even for us.
Oh, God.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they, those things, they're not the, they're not going to support the company or whatever as a whole thing, but they really, fire up the sales of the base game as well as the other expansions, as well as, the expansion itself that comes out. And so, I think that the ongoing popularity of AI War, for instance, is due to the ongoing both, free updates we do to the base game, as well as the ongoing, and balance to all the expansions, as well as the new expansions that we do. And, that keeps the game fresh. And so, you could easily put in like 100 hours to, version one of the game, mm-hmm. but, 600 would have been out of the question. And, now it's like, yeah, no problem. 600, you probably have seen maybe everything by then.
So whenever you have a game that gets into, say, like a Humble Bundle, right? And there's like six or eight games and I can buy the whole wad of them for like $6 or whatever. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then I say, well, 50% goes to charity and 50% goes to the developer or whatever. So I really bought like all those games for $3. So how does that work out for the developer? Do you turn massive enough numbers from a bundle sale like that you actually get a pretty nice check at the end of it?
Yeah. I mean, it's something that answer is going to vary by every sale, because it really, really depends on how much each individual contributor decides to allocate to the charity versus to the the Humble Tip and the developers, and that's something that trends over time during a single bundle. So I mean, you never know what it's going to wind up at, because of NDAs, I can't speak about certain specifics, but I mean, we were really pleased with being, just a weekly sale with our stuff. That was, I think our, public gross number was like 189, I think. And we were plenty pleased with the net that came to us.
I gotta say, even though you had that bundle, even though I own AI War already, I bought them all again. One, so I can give them two soundtracks.
Oh yeah. Pablo's
the man. So I mean, I love gaming soundtracks. You guys have great music in your games. The piano stuff in Skyward Collapse. Oh my God.
Yeah, that was so great. That was something that I noted today while I was going through the AI War tutorial. Was I just left it over there paused for a little bit, but I was enjoying the piano thing that was going on. Yeah. So I was just like, yeah, it's pretty cool. I need to find more of this. Yeah. Like, I need to make a playlist on Groove Shark of just like chill piano stuff to have on.
Pablo's versatile. He does a lot of vocal stuff. We've got some things that are, very, anime kind of inspired. I mean, like the theme song to Valley by That Wind 2, as yeah. well as Bionic Dudes. They're both very anime sounding. Yes. And then he's singing in Old Norse in the Skyward Collapse main theme, and then he's singing in Japanese in the expansion for Skyward Collapse, Nihon Nomura. And it's just like, dude, this is awesome, that he's able to, So it's...
I would like him to come to my next birthday party, actually. And
He's incredible. So, I love working with him.
Have you been working with him since the beginning?
Yeah. It was he and I were the first two. I mean, originally it was just me, and then I was like, my sister's an opera singer, and she was in school at the time for that. Yeah, and I was like, okay, so you know a bunch of musicians. Do you know a composer? And she's like, Pablo Vega. This is the guy. I was like, oh yeah, I think I've heard you talk about him before. I may have been to one of his performances or something over at UNC Chapel Hill. And she was like, yeah. And, so we'd kind of like briefly met before. But so we got up with one another a few months before AI War 1.0 came out. And, we you know, talked it through, and he did an awesome soundtrack for it. And then once AI Wars started, you know, taking off, then we were the, well, you know, the first and only. And so we decided to, you know, quit the day jobs and, you know, go full time at the end of 2009. And then now we're up to seven of us at the moment. But
is that one of the ways you guys keep pounding out games like you are?
Game after game. Yeah, I mean, we have the team now, and we have so many code assets from the past, and we've got, you know, an engine, you know, with Valor of That Wind 1, that took so long for its development. It was 18 months on that one game because we were developing out so many new types of everything. I mean, of new multiplayer model, of new just physics, all sorts of other code things. We were trying to figure out a bunch of graphical stuff. And so that was really an intensive process. With like AI War, the original development of that, the 1.0 version, took me 7 months by myself. Bionic Dues, we did that in 2 months. Had a staff of six doing it. So it actually was closer to like a little over a year of man hours, basically.
Wow.
So even though it was compressed into 2 months of real time, that's just good project management. It actually took longer to develop than the original AI War, and that's with not having to develop the multiplayer model, the, you know, and a bunch of other stuff that we just already had and could reuse under the hood. Nice. So, I mean, we're able to do that sort of thing just because we kind of have this economies of scale right now.
Yeah.
Right. So which is really nice.
So at what point in your business development did you decide, you know, to go from, I would assume, like, you know, you're working out of your home office or, you know, up to a certain point. And then at what point do you say, all right, we've got enough people, we need to actually rent office space now and hang a sign on the door?
For me, never. I mean, we all work out of our homes at this point as well. And, we're all over the country. I mean, there's three of us that are in North Carolina, one in Georgia, one in Spain, actually, although she's Swedish. yeah.
That goes along and with then, the Norse guy singing Japanese, right? So.
He's American, but he's originally from South America. So he's
Native
Spanish English speaker, singing Old Norse. But yeah, so and then we've got one in Washington State, and although he was in L.A. until recently, and one in Texas, although she might go back to Alaska. So, you know, it's you know, we're all over the place, and everybody works kind of alone together. There's a lot of, you know, coordination through Skype and email and so forth. But there's also a lot of need for kind of quiet focus time. And, you know, like with Pablo, he's got a home studio that he's set up for doing his recording and all that. And, you know, that needs, you know, a certain amount of quiet and all that sort of thing. So it,
do you guys just work out of like a GitHub repository and check stuff in and out?
We use SVN, yeah, repository hosting. We use them, and then the Google Drive we use in Trello, and we have a Mantis bug tracking system that we have set up for on our site, which our customers use as well. So we've got a variety of tools that we use depending on the you know, which you know, team you're talking about. The art mostly is through Google Drive, and the code and everything goes through SVN. But yeah, I mean, it works out really well. My prior job, I had been the CTO of another small company, and it was, you know, business to business software. And originally we had been in office space, and then we'd scaled back and worked out of our homes for several years. And I was like, you know, this works. There's no reason not to do this. There's, you know, why pay money to an office space? There's, and, you know, and you get an extra hour or two or however much of not having to commute. So, I mean, it's like,
that's. Oh, tell me about it. Ugh.
Yeah. I mean, that's, yeah.
That kills me every day. A little bit sad.
I did it for, you know, a decade or whatever. And yeah, I'm happy not to now.
Oh, I'm jealous. I would
no,
love
the to. Other end of this, you know, it's like you have to actually like get out of the house, because if you're at home like all day, you can become
you'll go nuts.
So
we brought you here to talk about an actual game. Wow.
Yeah, right?
Everywhere. Now, I do want to say one last thing about AI Wars, that not only did you kind of have that perfectly timed to kind of hit the crest of the indie wave that's been kind of coming in ever since, but also kind of the slow return of space gaming, really, the spaceship.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. There was a lot of comparisons of it to Sins of a Solar Empire at the time.
Yeah, not because
those games have anything in common.
Except the real-time thing. That is...
They're real-time and they're in space.
That's okay. It. Yeah, that's pretty much
it. I mean, it's like, okay, yeah. And it's kind of like when the comparison is being made because they're real-time and they're in space and that's why they're similar, it's like, wow, this is dead genre at the moment. It's like, man, you know, there's RTSs. They're on the ground and it's real time. There's, you can't tell Age of Empires from StarCraft. I don't know. It's the same thing. It's just like, well, no, there's a little bit of difference there.
Oh my God. I mean, they're both great games and, you know.
Yeah, I mean, but I mean, it's just, there is.
That's all there really was in 2009.
I like watermelons and I like strawberries, but I mean, there's a difference.
So since you kind of got in at the crest of the wave, as it were, how has all this whole, like, kind of resurgence thing looked from your end? I mean, is the competition good, do you think? Is it exciting? Are you a little worried about the competition? How's this looking from a developer's end, do you think?
Well, until this last year, honestly, I would have said, you know, I don't really feel like there's competition per se. I feel like the increase in, you know, the number of quality, you know, titles out there and so forth are really helping to lend both visibility and credibility to everything. And, you know, Cliff Harris and I, you know, have done a number of co-promotions with like gratuitous space battles and AI Wars.
Sure. Before.
And, you know, that's been really good for both of us. And
another very difficult game, by the way.
Yeah. Coming up more into this year, I've been getting a little bit more worried, just because there's starting to be a feeling of tightness in some areas. I should preface that by saying, you know, we are grossing more this year than we – and netting more this year than we ever have before.
Oh, wow.
So it's – I mean, that's been true every year except last year where we had some expenditures that didn't really pay off until this year. So it was a down year. But, but I mean, we've had revenue growth year over year. That said, some of our games have done – it's been tricky. Like Bionic Dues has sold well, but not as well as we thought it would, especially based on like the reviews and the player response, which has been, you know, phenomenal. Nothing has been as well received that we've done since AI War itself. Hmm. And it's been selling well, but not at the level that we really kind of had expected it to.
Hmm.
And so it's just kind of like, you know, if this had come out couple of years ago, this would have been a different story. And here it's just a matter of trying to get visibility. So, you know, it's one of those things we're working on. AI War started slow too. I mean, first 2 weeks, $0 sold.
Wow, you know, the next, really?
Oh yeah, literally. I mean, and then finally got on, you know, Stardock's Impulse. And then I think we made like, 16 grand or something like that over the course of the summer, and then got on Steam. And it was like 70 grand by the end of the year, all told from everything. And then, you know, and then it was kind of up from there. And it's, you know, been in the, you know, 150 to 200 something a year since then. But,
I appreciate you being candid about all these numbers.
Yeah, I'm going to help amazing. Out with Bionic Dues. I got it in Skyward Collapse in my Steam cart. Like right now, I'm looking at that purchase button. Here, let me know if you feel it. There it was.
I appreciate it. And yeah, it's my pleasure. I mean, you know, I always try and be candid because it's like, it's the information I would have wanted to have years ago.
Right.
And, you know, I've actually posted a big old postmortem of AI War stuff, looking at all sorts of numbers, all sorts of, you know, dates and this, that, and the other, and with huge breakdowns of everything. It's a long read. It's in our, Games by Design blog, off of the arcanegames.com website. Mm-hmm. But, you know, to answer your question, yeah, I think that the competition is something that I'm starting to feel a bit.
Mm.
That said, I think that for new developers, that's going to be felt a lot more harshly. And it's so six of one, half dozen of another, because it was so difficult to get on Steam back in the day.
It still seems like it is. Developers.
It's still really hard, but
I mean, did you see that not on Steam sale from about a month ago?
Yeah, that got them on Steam really quick, didn't it?
Some of those guys got on Steam like that week.
Yeah, it's an order of magnitude different, though. I mean, when you look at 2009, there would be like three or four releases that were indies a month, maybe. And you look now, and it's still hard to get on Steam, but way more stuff does. Right. And so, you know, the difficulty is still in, you know, getting noticed. And now there's more people paying attention to indies, but there's not – now there's more to pay attention to. So, I mean, it's kind of like an arms race there of, you know, how much attention is being paid versus how much is there to pay attention to. And, you know, oh, God, you know, now we have to sort all this stuff, some of which is very good, some of which is not. And, oh, God, there's so much stuff that is really good. What do we do? Can't play it all, you know.
Exactly. Like as a gamer, as a player, it's an amazing time.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't think I've ever been this spoiled for choice.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many things where I'm like, that is so awesome. I would totally sink time into that, but I also have this other thing.
Exactly.
Well, it's on sale. I guess I'll get it anyway. And hopefully I'll have time to get to it at some point.
Exactly. It's not a backlog anymore. It's a collection. You hope.
Yeah. And then also a lot of times it's like, well, okay, you know, this thing's on sale. I don't know if I'm going to have time to play this, but gosh darn it, that's cool. I'm going to support that developer.
Exactly.
You know? And I've had people that have said this, you know, that they've done that to me, you know, for Arkane as well. And, you know, I'm like, wow, that's really cool. I mean, I hope you actually, you know, play it and enjoy it at some point. But, you know, at the same time, thanks, you know. So it's, you know, it kind of comes back to that whole piracy argument, too. And my answer to that is always that, you know, It's a patron model, one way or the other. You know, people choose to patronize, you know, the companies they want to see more stuff from. And so some people choose to patronize things they don't actually play, or, you know, patronize the things that they, you know, want to see more. And they put in, like, you know, $500 or $5,000 on Kickstarter or whatever. And, I mean, you're really patronizing that then. You know, so I think that it's something that's just really cool that's come about this It's a brave new world in a really positive way.
Oh no, it's amazing. So speaking of indie games, you have a new one. Let's finally get to it. The Last Federation. It's a space game. It looks like it's a tactical, open worldy type, roguey, procedurally generated thingamajig.
That's not far off. It's people on our forums keep being like, is it like this? Is it like this? Sounds kind of like Space Rangers. Well, no.
No, it's not. No, I don't see it as Space Rangers. But.
Yeah, it sounds kind of like that. It sounds kind of like that. It's like, well, no, it's not really like any of these things. It's its own beast. It's really interesting. You play inside this solar system that's procedurally generated out the wazoo, and it's got all this simulation. So on one level, it's kind of a simulation game, sort of. Mm-hmm. So you could say, oh, it's, you know, all right, so it's SimCity or something, I guess. Except that plays itself. You know, you don't actually get to play. and then, so you're like, okay, so it's SimCity that I watch. Got it. What? So you play a strategy game set inside this SimCity that plays itself in space. And so you play as a mercenary fleet. You're not playing as any, like, particular faction, although there's these eight races that and pirates and some other stuff that are going on around you. And so you're, for some various reasons, trying to convince everybody to form a federation. And, of course, none of them are inclined to do this. And so you're kind of mostly at first, in particular, flying under the radar. And, I mean, you have to deal with pirates and stuff. And, you know, the races are kind of becoming spacefaring as it goes. They're all, like, spying on each other. And one race got spacefaring. The others are like, damn it, we better catch up. And, you know, it's kind of a space race but cross-planet. And So there's these eight races on eight planets, and they're all trying to get, you know, spacefaring as quickly as possible. And you can, like, smuggle them spacefaring tech if you want to. And, you know, that'll kind of piss off potentially some other folks if they find out you did it. But, you know, if you manage to get there without alerting them, then hooray, you've just made a new friend who's now in space and might accidentally cause trouble for you. But hey,
is there an Armageddon victory condition where you just, like, glass all the planets and then...
Not in so many words, but you could wind up with a situation where, like, potentially all but one of the planets gets glassed, and that planet was in the Federation. It's like, whoa, you've created a Federation of one. You know, it's like.
But really, it seems like the goal is that you're sort of a peace broker, though, because you're trying to, you know, you have your sphere of influence, and you want to bring people into the fold rather than nuke them.
Yes, you're trying to make them get along, and some of them are more inclined to do that than others. And you have kind of these competing things that can emerge depending on what all is going on. Like, if the pirates get out of control, you might run into, like, a pirate empire that forms, and it's like, oh, man.
Ooh,
and, yeah. Cool. You can have if a couple of races start, like you know, there's eight planets. If two different races each have two planets or more, then they'll form a solar axis pact where it's kind of like, all right, we're going to ally and just, like, take everyone else on. And it's like, oh, no, things are going downhill at that point. I mean, you better hope the Federation's fairly strong or that you can somehow break up the solar axis pact some other way. And then there's the fear empires, which can come up, where if there's one race that controls half the solar system, then it creates a fear empire, and, like, everybody else is just, you know, that creates some problems. And there's some other things that can happen, too.
So the difference between Chris and Peter Molyneux is that Chris actually delivers these features that he talks about.
Yeah, it's, yeah, I'm not going to go there, but...
Thank you.
But yeah, we have, you know, we're talking concretely here, not pie in the sky.
So basically there are eight races on eight planets, and at the start of each game, I'm guessing each race can have a different posture. Like, race A could be a nice race in game one, but in game two, they could be a bastard, and they'll interact differently based on postures.
They have innate characteristics that are always the same. That are, you're gonna like this though. So you have, like, the Burleths, and I hope I don't get in trouble, but these guys are kind of Klingonish in a lot of ways. I mean, they're just this warrior society, and they're really just bad dudes.
I hope they have good. I hope they have good Klingon music that plays.
Star Trek did not invent the warrior race.
No.
So I don't think
these guys have feathered behinds and chicken feet. So, I mean, it's okay.
So they're Mongolian space chickens.
They look terrifying, but yeah,
terrifying. Yes.
And then you've got the like the Thraxians, which are like these hive guys, which are, you know, kind of like buggers or whatever from Ender's Game. Right. And then you've got the Acutians, which are these really kind of industrial robots race. Then you've got the Borines, which are like these kind of snow pig creature guys. And then one of my favorites, I did not do this on purpose, they're named the Evux. And actually I was going to tell you about the Peltians. Excuse me. There's the Peltians, and they're kind of like fat Ewoks in some respects. They don't look like bears, but they're just these kind of fuzzy creatures, and they're agrarian and they're pathetic, but gosh darn it, if they aren't good at bombing the heck out of stuff from space. And so we realized the pun belatedly, where it's like, oh, Peltian, ha, you know. That was totally unintentional. It's like pelt, like their coat, you know. But you know, and so nice. You've got some other ones that are, you know, more like technological and so forth. So there's these innate things, you know, the Burleths are jerks all the time. And,
okay.
You know, the Thraxians, you know, they're also kind of like a cross between, like, the aliens, like, you know, Ridley Scott type stuff. They're, you know, beasts in ground combat. You know, it doesn't take many of them to just rip up the other side if they land their troops.
So does this, and so, does this all go on in one solar system? Because you were talking about planets. Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's a crowded solar system with, you know, eight sentient planets.
So does it procedurally generate the solar system and everything that's going on? Every new game is different?
Yeah. So that was where I was going next, actually, is so the races have these innate characteristics, right? I mean, the Klingons are the Klingons, you know. Okay, we generally know what that means. Fine. But what their attitudes and situation are is really, really different each game, procedurally speaking, because there's 11 different classes of planets that could go in four different zones. So essentially the solar system, you got the sun at the center, right? Then you've got the inner system, which is very hot. Then you've got the habitable zone. Okay, fine. Then you've got the asteroid belt, pirates, basically, and some other space installations. Then you've got the outer system, you know, with gas giants and whatnot. And then you've got the ice belt, which is, you know, like Plutoids and whatnot, as well as, you know, more space installations. And so, depending on what kind of planet, each particular race is put on, their general posture and so forth, may be drastically different. So you say, fine, the Burlesque are jerks and they're warlike, but if they're on an ice planet, these guys love fire. They're going to be struggling. So it's like, you know, Klingons on the brink of desperation, and they can hardly mount an army. They're just pathetic. But then you've got, like, let's say the Peltians, which are like, you know, fat Ewoks, and they're on, you know, this molten planet, and they're like, oh, God, we're going to die. We are not suited for this. But they're like, this encourages us to develop technology. And, like, the Skylaxians, like, ally with them, and suddenly they've got all this technology. And the next thing you know, the Peltians are, like, the scourge of the solar system. It's like, what? The Ewoks? Are you kidding me? You know, and it's like, the Klingons are like, help me, the Ewoks are killing me. You're like, sorry, Klingons, there's nothing I can do.
Well, you know? They stay pretty much on their own planet, or let's say two races go into some sort of like a pact with each other, like you're talking about. Mm-hmm. Do they then cross-populate each other's planets, or will you see the Ewoks all, like, emigrate en masse off the lava world and go to the nice jungle planet where they want to be?
So the way that we have it set up now, mainly for the sake of simplicity, and this is a game I should stress we may, you know, assuming it does well, I would love to evolve this over a long period of time. But for the sake of player comprehension and so forth, we're trying to keep certain rules a bit simple. And so right now each planet is controlled by one race, and if another race takes that planet over, then it's just – basically genocide. I mean, whoops. But nice. you know, if the first race already controls two planets, then okay, that race wasn't completely wiped out. And actually, there's a high likelihood that there's some pirate installations by, you know, one race anyhow, and they may have some space stations that they still live on or whatever. So it's not completely wiping them out, probably.
So go ahead, sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, so besides the planets that these races on, they can build space stations.
Yeah, they're functional things. So they're like science labs or ore refinery places or factories or these military stations that help them build ships faster and that they can dock other ships at. And, you know, so there's those things. Also a black market spaceport that you can go and shop at and do some other things at. But most of your, you know, everything is pretty much taking place in space. You get kind of a atmospheric view of the planets, you know, when you're in some of the menus, but you never, like, go down to the ground view and see anything. Sure. You know, you're kind of seeing the zoomed out view of the solar system a lot of the time. And then, well, and then you're in various, like, negotiation menus and stuff too, where you're, like, you know, seeing the aliens you're talking to and then taking on some sort of contract. And then there's the combat, which is, you know, side view and in space. And
okay, so when you have these races and you can get contracts, like you just said, for them, Like, are the contracts like kill these pirates or deliver this cargo or like what kind of contracts are we talking
about? And how do you get
them?
Do you go to like a mission terminal and it's like these are the things that I could potentially do?
Well, you've got your fleet and you dock your fleet somewhere, like at a planet or at a space station, basically. And depending on where you are, there's maybe a market that you can shop at and you can buy like informants or like, you know, pay off some folks or whatever at the planets, or you can like literally buy tech or whatever. And then there's contracts that vary depending on what sort of place you're at. And not all of the contracts are this may be a place where we reorganize the interface a little bit. It's one of those things we're still kind of figuring out. But functionally speaking, we're calling these all contracts for the sake of simplicity. We've got them broken out into a couple of different categories, which right now are military, smuggling, bargaining, gifts, outsourcing. And we may add one more category, which may be event.
But he has gifts. Do you simulate alien holidays?
You know, that's a good idea. Oh, God. We're going to add that.
It's Klingon Christmas.
Klingon Christmas. Yeah, that is awesome. We're going to have that. We're totally going to have that.
Klingmas?
Klingmas. Yeah, so, I mean, like, under the military section, contracts can be for somebody or against somebody. You can, like, undertake a contract that isn't per se and this is where the term contract's a little bit misleading, because it's like it's not necessarily something that somebody hired you to do. You may make somebody very happy from what you did, or let me give an example. Being more concrete is good. So there's an outpost. There's somebody who owns it. They built this science lab, and you're like, hey, nice. Be ashamed if something happened to that, you know. And so you fly over there, and you're like, you know, I could really use a science lab, you know, because I want to do some science. And so maybe they've got a couple of defense ships parked there. So one of the contracts you can then take at this thing is attack outpost. There's nobody that's really hiring you to do this per se, but you know, if you win, then you know, you get some money from it and you know, destroy one of their defenders, attack it again, last of the defenders are gone, you can capture the outpost. And of course, one of the consequences of this is whoever owns it, you're losing influence with them because they're pissed. They're just like, what are you doing? You're attacking me. You destroyed two ships, took my science thing. Jerk, you know. And so at this point now you own a science lab, right? And so it's like, well, it doesn't really do anything for you normally. It just kind of sits there and you're like, great, I've got a science outpost. So this is where both gifts and outsourcing come in. So you go somewhere else and you've got this science lab, it's of no help, and you go to this, you know, other race, or maybe even the race you stole it from, whatever, and you say, hey, I've got this outpost. Would you like it? Here, I give it to you as a gift. And they're like, oh, thank you. You know, we'd like you a little better, you know. And so you could, you know, and then, of course, they can use it. And so not only did you make them like you a little bit better, but if, like, the Klingons are really having a trouble because the Ewoks are just, you know, trampling them, you're like, here, Klingons, have a science lab. Maybe you can put something together. You know, it's like, we took this from the big bad Ewoks and we give it to you. And the Ewoks are like, we hate you. And the Klingons are like, we love you. And you're like, all right, this is backwards. And, you know, the Ewoks are then like sending assassins. I'm not kidding. And then like the Klingons are like, you know, gifting you stuff.
Well, the Ewoks, like, in addition to having Life Day, should have Bombing Day. And it's actually a holiday where they just gift everybody with bombs from orbit.
Is there like a news feed where you can keep up on all these happenings?
Yeah, you can pause it at any time and you can see what events are going on a planetary basis, as well as what racial actions the individual races are taking, which could be a kind of a cross-planet thing. So they may be involved in things like, you know, you might have a stock market boom on one planet and another one that had a nuclear plant accident or whatever. And so then there's these kind of, you know, issues. You have this patriotism rise on this planet that's not part of the Federation. And so then the Anti-Federation Alliance membership is like soaring, and you might have demonstrators, you might have insurgents, and those cause problems. And that's kind of another sub-faction that causes you issues as you play. And
One thing that I would really love to see in a lot of games, because this sounds like a game where the user interface and situational awareness are going to be of utmost importance, because I need to know what's going on. So and that's not necessarily well serviced in some games, because you'll pull up a, you know, you get like a little spreadsheet that's got some information, or you'll get sort of an abstract graph of what the what the influence levels of civilizations are or whatever. What I wish that developers would do is actually have like a social media simulation inside, so the Ewoks would actually like tweet like, haha, we're off to bomb the Klingons. And, you know, where they would actually, like, post updates of what they're doing that you could follow.
Oh, that's hilarious. And, you know, Ridiculous Fishing did that. They had a it's not a strategy game. It's a little iPhone game. It's hilarious. But they did a little Twitter thing. That worked out.
Yeah, there was
a
lot of drugs involved in the development of that game, I think.
Yeah. So, I mean, with what you're saying, the situational awareness is important. But here's the thing to remember with this game is that you are a mercenary. You're in charge of your mercenary fleet. You know, you have ships. They take damage. Whatever damage they have remains after battle. You have to pay to refit. If you had crew that died, you have to hire. It's not difficult, but you have to do it. you know, you pretty much just hit refit, and if you have the money, it does it. These are your immediate concerns. You know, do you have the bank balance to buy stuff? What is the tech level of your ships? What kinds of ships do you have? You know, do you have dreadnoughts, or do you have something crappy? Do you want some corvettes? You can do a smuggling run, you know, but, you know, dreadnought on the smuggling run? I don't think so. You know, that ain't going to happen. So these are your immediate concerns. This is you. And you lose the game by dying. If your flagship goes down, you're in the flagship, you're dead, bye. That is you, and you can fly around. But you can look at any of the planets at any time. You can pause at any particular point, too, and say, you know, what is going on at these planets? You can see the influence. You can see little fleets flying around. If there's this, you know, the Peltians are, like, bombing the heck out of the Ewoks, bombing the heck out of, you know, the buggers, you know, whatever. Then, you know, you're seeing this stuff going across, and you're like, what's all that? You know, oh boy. And we do intend to have, this is again part of where we're still in kind of a pre-alpha thing. We're trying to work out contextual things where it's like, this is super important. You know, let us tell you about this. And, the racial actions, that exist, there's always exactly two per race, no matter how many planets they have. And so there's one central screen that shows, you know, the overall broad things they're doing. So that would be like, I'm attacking the Klingons, or we're dumping all the money we have into starship production, or help, we're defending against the Klingons, you know. And those particular actions are really broad. And they don't speak to everything that's going on, obviously, because there's this whole other simulation on each planet going on. There's little events going on and so forth. But all the stuff that is super important, you know, war scale sort of things, are really kind of reflected on that. And you can kind of check, you know, what is the general health of, you know, planets? Population is dropping over here. What is going on? Ah, volcanoes, you know. And so...
Well, remember how Master of Orion had the Galactic News Network that would pop up and be like, these are the things that went on this month.
I'll confess to not having played that one. I'm sorry. But, I know it's sacrilege, right?
Whoa!
Well, it's been fun.
Good old game! $6! Come on!
I know. I'll get sucked in.
You know, you're probably right. You would. It's still the pinnacle of that particular subgenre. Really, to this day.
It's on my list. You know what I mean? It's one of those things.
Oh, no, totally.
Yeah, that game caught lightning in a bottle, and nobody has been able to do it since. And
people have tried. But so this sounds pretty awesome. So basically it sounds like you have a fleet, and you can pause, and you can see what's going on these particular planets. And I'm like, and you can see, oh, this planet has a need for this, or they have this particular mission. I'll go over here and take this mission or contract from them. And then do that, And, oh, they have this thing for sale, but I need more money, so maybe I could. Is there trading in the game?
There is. You can buy and sell ships, mostly at the black market, and you can capture ships as well. It's hard to do, and you won't do it often, but there is, you know, trade in a sense of economy between the other planets, but you're not really involved in that terribly much. You can broker deals between them, which they all have attitudes towards one another as well. And so you can make them improve their attitudes towards one another by, you know, having trade, and they therefore like each other better over time as they're happy. So you can, that's an example of one kind of contract where you can say, okay, these two guys are kind of neutral to one another, but I'd love to bring them both into the Federation. How can I best do this? Let's see. Well, I want to make them like each other better first. Then I want to get them teched up some if I can. You know, they're doing okay on their own, but I'd like to kind of accelerate their natural growth. So I'm going to go over here and, you know, blah, 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 blah. You know, and so you have this kind of strategy of like threads you're going to pull, and a lot of it involves like shooting other ships and stuff, you know. But, you know, so it's like, all right, let's see. I'm going to do this, and okay, let's bring the guns, and, you know. So, so there's a lot of kind of indirection there, and it makes it kind of sandboxy, because if you decide that, okay, for some reason the Klingon planet has a fleet of whatever size, and you're like, all right, here I go. I'm going to take on their planetary fleet because I'm awesome and I think I can do it, and then I'm going to bomb their population back into the Stone Age and then, you know, see who comes and takes them over. Well, you can do that, and, you know, the Klingons will hate you, and whoever else, you know, comes in and takes their planet is not going to be particularly grateful. But if there's somebody who's already in the Federation, they're just like, woohoo, free planet, you know, then it's like, all right, yes, now I'm, you know, three planets into the Federation because, yeah, I killed somebody. But
so what's the player's point of insertion into the game? Like the game starts, it's the first moment. Do you have a star base and a small fleet, and you're not affiliated with anybody else?
So when the game first starts out, you're actually part of you're the last surviving member of actually a ninth race that was the first one that was spacefaring, and their planet got blown up by some other race, but you don't know which one it was.
Coming in the expansion,
yeah. The one of the other races blew up your planet because they weren't spacefaring in the sense of being like able to do starflight, but I mean neither are we, you know what I mean? But we can certainly launch stuff, you know. And so they were launching some stuff, and because your race, the Chelonians, had been kind of hogging the spacefaring tech and preventing anybody else from getting into space for a few centuries, and nobody else really liked that. And they decided to, you know, bomb you and become spacefaring. So then, long story short, you wind up going through some stuff where you wind up stealing one of the potential flagships for the first race that actually winds up becoming spacefaring. They use technology that you smuggled them, and they're not entirely friendly to you because they'd been imprisoning you for a little while, and then you stole one of their potential their flagship candidates, and so they're actually pretty pissed at you. And so your first battle is with your giant flagship against one of their pathetic things, and you know, unless you're really bad, you're just gonna, you know, just ream it into combat, and then you're off into the galaxy, solar system. I always call it galaxy because of AI war. Eventually I'll break that habit, but then I'll start saying solar system and AI war, go figure, right? But, yeah. So at that point, one planet is spacefaring and none of the other seven are. The other ones are all working furiously on becoming spacefaring, as well as sending spy probes to the planet that actually, or planets, depending on the time, that are spacefaring. And the, depending on how close they are to the original planet, they'll be getting faring more or less quickly. You can obviously accelerate that by going over and like helping out. Otherwise, at default speed, which you can fast forward through if you it's kind of like SimCity, you know, where sometimes you're like, let me just let the sim run for a little bit. And
yeah.
You know what I mean?
So something happens, yeah.
Yeah, it's like, you know, I like where things are. Let me let this run, and then, okay, stop. Now it's time to, you know. And so, you know, in terms of, like, real time, assuming it's not fast-forwarded, it would be, on average, about 45 minutes till they're probably all spacefaring, unless you help them out. And so it's getting gradually more complicated with people who hate each other and who like each other, and things are happening and, you know, whatnot. And, you know, right from the get-go, you can start running missions against the spacefaring race that you started with. You get to choose which one it is. Or you can start running missions, you know, for them to kind of help them some. Or you can just kind of start helping other people become spacefaring or do some other stuff that's kind of to the side. I mentioned the outsourcing. You can help. You can, like, lend your science lab, for instance, or your factory to a race to help them, you know, speed up ship construction or level up their fleet quicker. And so there's a bunch of other things that you can do. You know, you can do the spungling runs to, like, you know, get some needed economic goods from one race to another and, you know, help their economy. Or and you get bargaining power through things. So you can, you know, kind of throw your weight around to say, you know, kind of political influence, basically.
So this Federation and has no concept of the Prime Directive.
It's not at all. It's really the inverse Prime Directive.
You should it call totally the game is. Prime Directive as a joke. Just be
like, call it inverse Prime Directive. That gets some people looking.
Secondary Directive. my God.
Yeah. So you start out, and there's a limited number of – the sandbox is smaller, but it's still super important what you do then. So it's one of those things where it's like, okay, you have a moment to kind of catch your breath. Things aren't wild and complicated, but the decisions that you make now matter, because if you piss off whoever it is that you're working with right off, maybe that matters, maybe that doesn't. Depends on, you know, what you're planning to do, you know. And eventually you're hoping, you know, there is no Federation at the start of the game. This is an idea in your head. It's something you want to create, but there's no Federation. There's just you, the mercenary fleet, and then these eight planets. That's it. And once you get two planets, at least two races, I should say, not two planets really, but two races, convinced that, yeah, okay, this Federation thing sounds like a good idea. We'll join it together. Then finally the Federation exists, and then, you know, you go from there. But it's a while before there even is a Federation. And so, there's a while there where you're just trying to kind of maneuver things to get it where you want. And that might be a very militaristic, I'm going to be the baddest cat in town sort of strategy, or it might be something where you're a little more stealthy. You know, you're really building a fleet of Corvettes and stuff, or, you know, there's a variety of things that you could do. So
now you're talking about these different ships, like Corvettes and flagships and battleships. Could you, like, customize your fleet to do different missions? Like, say you want a smuggling mission, like you mentioned earlier, you could buy and sell some different speedier ships that might get through the smuggling run more quickly instead of these ponderous, you know, battleships. Is that kind of what's going on here?
Yeah, you can maintain a fleet of whatever size you want, really. And so
can you split the fleet, or do you travel as a fleet everywhere?
You travel as a fleet, but combat is always 1v1. Hold on 1 second. Sorry, losing my ability to speak there. Allergy season.
Oh no.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm good. So you don't split the fleet, but we are pondering the idea of having, like, dispatch missions where you send off one ship at a time, but we haven't implemented that yet. It's one of those ideas that we might do something with at some point. But you move your whole fleet around, and then when it's like, okay, it's combat time or time to run a smuggling run or whatever, then it says, okay, here's the opposition. You know, what ship of yours are you sending in? And so you have a chance at that time to say, all right, I'm going to, you know, sitting in my Wolf Corvette against their, you know, it's a level 10 Wolf Corvette. They've got a level 5 Ox Corvette. Let's, you know, let's go. I'm going to get those guys, you know, it's no problem. There's some different classes of, you know, even individual types of Corvettes. The ships themselves are procedurally generated. And there's so much procedural generation. It's all over the place.
Yay.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, the types of Corvettes you might see in a game, there may be only one type of Corvette. It's possible. The first race will have a Corvette and a frigate to start out with. And it's possible that every other race that comes after will steal their Corvette and frigate designs, and that there's only ever one. And it's like, okay, we've got Ram Corvettes and nothing else. That's exceedingly unlikely. There's more likely there's going to be somewhere between 1 and 8 different types of Corvettes. 8 is also very unlikely because that meant nobody stole from anybody else, which is also really unlikely. IP theft is higher than that. And so, you know, probably better guess is, you know, like 4 to 5 somewhere in there, you know, different types of Corvettes. And, you know, some may be, you know, markedly superior to others in a, you know, Corvette versus Corvette fight, but, they may have specialties against something else. You know, you may have a Corvette that's particularly good at just making it through a smuggling run. It's not going to kill anybody, but, you know, it's good at just getting through. And there's, you know, another one that's good at kind of surgical strikes or whatever. And then you've got like the Dreadnought and the battle cruisers that are, you know, those don't come out for a while. There's a nice progression of ships and they get progressively more beastly looking.
Nice.
So
that's how it should work. That's exactly how it should work.
Yeah. So, you know, and there's a progression of technology within each ship line as well. And, all these little drones and stuff that you deploy out of the individual ships is a big part of it. As during combat, you're not just like firing your own guns. You are some, but more often than not, you're deploying drones, and then they're doing firing, and you're managing your drones versus the enemy drones, and then also deciding when to do things like, you know, boost your shields, or depending on what abilities you're ship has, you know, hit your reverse thrusters real hard, or, you know, do some sort of EMP burst or some sort of other, like, you know, kind of special action. It really depends. Some of the lower ships don't have a lot in terms of options, but there's still tactics to it. And the combat is brutal. I mean, it is fast. There's some options where we're going to have, like, you know, you can pause at any time in the combat as well. Just hit spacebar and it's paused. Hit spacebar, it's not paused. We're going to have some options so that, like, every time your energy tanks charge, that it'll auto-pause for people who want to make it a little more turn-based. But if you're playing it in real time, you start out at longer range, and then you're closing range as you go. And different weapons become more useful as you close range. And, or even, you know, viable at all. Cause like auto cannons are just, you can't even use those at long range, and then they kind of stink at middle range, and then they're deadly at short range. So, at any rate, you know, trying to get their shields down and all that. And then, if a battle lasts more than 2 minutes, I'd be surprised. And a lot of times it's like 45 seconds, just ripping and tearing. And it's really cool. It's a unique combat model. I'm really pleased with how it's turned out. We went through a lot of different models and then came up with this.
No, that sounds awesome. I mean, the combat will be quick, and it sounds like the pacing of this game is very gaining momentum as you go. And it sounds like, you know, some games, they're like, you'll be chugging along, and then combat, boom, like, you gotta stop everything
right
for this combat.
Right. And, right. And I've been toying with the idea of like a Total War type auto resolve as well.
I was just about to ask about that.
Yeah, I haven't, you know, I worry about the game seeming too small without the combat part, because there's so much tactics in the combat. But then again, I mean, I really didn't like the combat in Total War, and I really loved the macro game. So I just auto-resolved every battle, and I had a grand old time, you know. So, and it was a smaller game, you know, that way. Right. But I didn't care. I had fun, you know, leave me alone. So it's just kind of like, all right, well, you know, so we probably will wind up doing that. And, you know, we do have it where it'll simulate using the AI, you know, what one ship would do versus another ship so that, you know, when enemy ship, third party, not your fleet ships attack other third party, not your fleet ships, you know, so it knows what the result should be. So we can just say, you know, with the auto resolve, okay, this is, you know, this is the going rate. If you think you can beat the AI, then play it.
So do you have any, do you have any pre-alpha footage that's maybe on YouTube or something so I can see this in action? Cause I saw screenshots on the website, but I don't know if you have anything like movieable yet.
We don't have anything movieable yet, mainly because, we have so many pieces of temporary graphics in there. We've been really careful to make sure, okay, here's a screenshot we can show that's completely finished. But then, you know, it's just one of those things where, you know, the art is being done in tandem with the coding and all that. And we don't want to show something that looks tacky, because a lot of people don't really understand quite how the hot dog is made. And we made the mistake of doing that with Valley 1, where we were showing like really early placeholder art to show off the gameplay, and people were just gripe about the art. And it's like, okay, well, you know, what about the gameplay? That's what we're actually, you know, showing. But, you know, we're close enough at this point that, I think we're going to be starting to have some footage. I would bet by the end of November, if not within the first week of December. So it's coming up pretty quick.
Oh, cool. Now, does your fleet, like, I didn't hear mention of this, that's why I'm asking, is there like any kind of role-playing model in the game where your ships gain experience and levels and all that fun stuff, like captains go up in levels and there's admirals or anything like that?
We've thought about doing a morale system, but we decided to ditch that because it was a little bit overcomplicated for the player. We may wind up doing something along those lines later, but at heart, really, what I want this game, you know, it's a strategy game inside a simulation game is really what this game is at heart. And there's a tactics game inside the strategy game. So, okay, it's Inception, but the RPG like aspects, there is some bit of that flavor just because there's, you know, events that are happening and there's kind of an inherent story being told, you know, like if you're playing like StarCraft or whatever, I mean, you know, there's guys being created, and I'm not down on StarCraft. I love it. It's fun. But, you know, there's guys being created and there's the story of the battle of the one guy versus the other guy and when the base got, you know, destroyed or whatever. And that's kind of the same thing with like AI War or whatever, you know, it's like there's the story of the epic battle at this planet. And, you know, I love telling that story. It was hilarious. And, you know, this is the awesome, you know, battle that happened here. But with the Last Federation, it's more like, you know, can you believe what those Klingons did? I couldn't believe it. You would never have thought it from the Klingons. I mean, you know, first they went all pacifist and then they busted it out and they were like best of buds with the Ewoks and the Ewoks stabbed them in the back. I couldn't believe it, you know? And so there's this kind of emergent quasi story. It's not like reading a book or something, but I mean, it's a series of events that happen and you kind of, I love reading like Dwarf Fortress or Boat Murdered and so forth, like the crazy let's plays that happen. And I think that's kind of what I'm getting at. There's no like story there per se. It's not an RPG, but there's this, the player winds up with a story. It's like those stupid elves and, you know, the elves are like, dude, why did you like molten lava all the trees? You know? And you're like, because, you know, apes. And so,
because they were there,
you know, and so it's like, okay, you know, so there's dialogue, you know what I mean? And there's, you know, you're inferring story from that, you know, and that's the same sort of thing with The Last Federation, but it's not like, okay, you know, it's not Final Fantasy, you know, where it's like, there's this scripted story. So, that makes it fairly, I would say that it has a little bit of RPG flavor in the same sense that something like Dwarf Fortress does, but it's not an RPG in the sense that there's no experience or whatever. Instead, there is leveling up of your like your fleet technology levels and so on. Your whole fleet at a go, and that's more like a strategy game, or like Bionic Dudes with like how the robots level up, or
you know
things like that. It's more of a it's more of a strategic, you know, it's representing the arms race. It's not so much a avatar power sort of thing.
Right. Okay. Well, I can live with that. You want to make the game playable. You're right. You don't want to make it overtly
complicated. And you never know in terms of expansions, the richness of a place like this is really high. And there's so many different things I've thought of. They were like, oh, we could totally slot this into this universe. And, you know, if this catches on, it would be really fun to do a lot of things. I think that having more RPG-like progression for parts of it might be part of it. Having, you know, it'd almost be fun to build in like a shmup into part of it. Like, you know, optional, of course. But, you know, like where you get to kind of like do the speed run as a shmup or something. That would be like crazy, you know? But, you know, where it's just like becomes this really like all-encompassing space game that does all sorts of mess. That would be fun to me. But, you know, it really depends on what the reception is. And as a strategy game inside a simulation game, you know, that's enough for me for right now. And I think that's really unique as it stands.
Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, I'm totally thrilled. When I first saw the announcement, I was like, I was very excited. So it sounds, you said you're going to have some footage by the end of the month. When are we talking about alpha, beta, playable, release, stuff like that?
So we're looking at starting doing an internal private alpha with our players probably right around the 1st of December.
Mm.
The question of a public beta is still an open one. We may do one for a week or two. It really just depends. The 1.0 release we're expecting to be in January.
Okay. Well, that's not far away at all.
No, no. So it's a fairly short time frame. So, you know, there's always the possibility of a little bit of slippage, but I would be surprised if it slipped more than a month, and I'm really hoping it doesn't slip even a month. But we're going full guns on it at the moment, and it's coming together. So, and we still have a lot of interface work to do, and a lot of, you know, the art has to be finished, and
right.
You know, this and that all over the place. You know, there's sawdust and all that stuff everywhere. But you know, it's becoming a recognizable game where, like, you know, not only does this simulation work, but this is cool. You know, this makes sense. It's understandable.
Right. So. Well, that feels like a good place to wrap it up, because I don't know about you, but I'm getting real tired. It's late on your end. You know,
it's my squeaky chair.
Oh my gosh. That feels like a good place to wrap this up.
Because
we talked about a lot of stuff, but I'm glad we learned more about the last Federation. I almost called it the next Federation, but it's not the last.
No, that'll be the expansion. Will be the next Federation.
Oh my god. No, I was watching The Next Generation last night. That's why it's in my head.
Oh.
But, Chris, I want to thank you so much for taking the time out of what I'm sure is a very busy schedule with all these pies spinning at the same time, all these plates spinning at the same time to come on and talk to us.
Yeah, I appreciate your taking an interest. So,
well, of course. I mean, it's what I do. That's what we do. But, yeah, thank you so much for coming on. And, folks, as always, thank you for listening. And everyone have a fabulous night or day, wherever you are. I don't know.
Let's have some music in here, Boiler. Sure thing.